And welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Robert Bevall, Robert Schock, Laird Scranton, Marie D. Jones, Micah Hanks, John Ward, and Scotty Roberts, organizer of the upcoming symposium, Paradigm Symposium. And I wanted to get into a little bit more now of the future. There's, of course, so much more we can talk about when it comes to the past and some of the elements, I guess, that we have left out in a way. There could be argued that the path that we're on right now is not the best one. As you were talking, Robert Schock, earlier, I just wanted to bring back one point, because last time you were with us, we talked about, with some concern about the solar flares and the sun activity. There'd been some warnings around 2012, 2013. NASA had come out with some warnings. This is, of course, an element which is basically outside of human control. It doesn't really matter what we do to change our lifestyle or you know, how we run civilization, basically. This would be outside of that. But I briefly wanted to bring in that point and ask you, Robert Schock, if you had any knowledge of the sun cycle, and if this seems to be, you know, if we've kind of come and gone through the maximum of that cycle, and that warning seems to have kind of passed away at this stage. What do you think, Robert Schock?
I will say very bluntly, I don't think it's come and gone at all. I think this ties in with what I was talking about during the first segment, that we really need to be thinking long term. All the evidence indicates that the sun has a very long-term cycle. We know that it has a number of different cycles, whether it's a sunspot cycle of about 11 years in reversing polarity, you know, sunspots coming and going. There are longer cycles on the order of on the order of centuries. There's one that's about 200 years. There are others that are on the order of a couple of millennia. And there is one cycle, I believe, that's on the order of 10,000 to 12,000 years, where the sun goes through periods of great agitation, great activities, then seems to calm down for literally thousands of years, then goes back into a point of, talking anthropomorphically, really a period of agitation, of increased activity. And when you look at the data over the last 12,000 years, all the indications are that we're going into this period of increased activity. And what you have during a period of increased activity with the sun are highs and lows. So you do have points where it's very active, seems to be very active, giving off major solar flares, a lot of activity. Then it seems to calm down. But that's a very short-term phenomenon within the larger cycle. And I think we talked last time I was on the show alone with you about the Carrington event in 1859, a major solar outburst, coronal mass ejection, as it's known, solar flares accompanying it, probably a solar proton event. I say probably because there was no way to measure that in 1859. And that was during what seemed to be a lull, a short-term period of relatively ho-hum activity of the sun. So just because things have calmed down for a year or two or three or even 5 years or a decade doesn't mean anything, in my opinion, in terms of the long-term cycles. And we now have modern society totally dependent upon electricity. And I mean totally dependent upon electricity. Think about what would happen if the power grid went down and stayed down for days, months, or weeks throughout much of the developed world. Think what would happen if communication systems went down. Think of what would happen if all our sophisticated electronic gear, from cell phones to computers and everything else, went down. All our records that are kept only electronically. And it's very clear that if we had an 1859 size event occur today, that's exactly what would happen. So I think we are very, very ill-prepared, and a lot of this goes back to what I was trying to emphasize before, that we in modern society tend to think very, very short-term, and we don't take into account nature and the vulnerabilities that we have. I think one thing that we can learn from the ancients is that they realized they were part of a bigger picture. They are part of nature, and I think we've sort of lost that.
Let me ask a kind of an open-ended question here, or anyone can jump in here and see what your take on this is, because I've always been very fascinated with what this disconnection is and how it actually came about, if we indeed have an ancient civilization or many different civilizations around the globe that are very much in tune with the cycles, very much in touch with everything, and then at some point I think that there's a multitude of events that led to this, of course, but at some point we seem to just kind of progressively start to lose this connectivity and we move in a different direction. There are certainly things that we still do that are very much tied to the natural cycles, but we're very much like we live in a little, you know, glass bubble or something like that. But I want to hear from all of you guys, see what you have and what your take is on why we've lost this and why we can potentially, how we can begin to bring this back again in some way. So anyone who feels want to jump on that?
I'm going to jump in.
Go ahead, Robert Bevall.
Well, yes, I was hearing attentively what Robert Schock was saying. And also the point you brought out, really, that, and that's why Egypt, I know that I'm very focused on Egypt, but Egypt is a very good example. When one studies the geological history of Egypt and the beginning of what appears to be the roots of civilization there, you've got a land. Egypt is a land that is very cyclical. Unfortunately, now because of the big dam, as John Ward pointed out, has interrupted a natural cycle that was happening for millennia, for thousands and thousands of years, which is of course the flooding of the Nile, the rhythm of the Nile, and how it, in a sense, is regulated by the activities of the sky. The position of the sun causes the rains in Central Africa and causes the flood of the Nile. And the Egyptians, the very early Egyptians, were, although they didn't know the source of the Nile and they didn't know the cause of it, they were very in tune with this cycle. And they seem to have geared their social structure, their social system, to integrate with this cycle. And that's very visible in Egypt even today. If you go outside the town areas and you go along the Nile, John Ward will affirm this, you see people living in very, very close connection with their natural surroundings. The Nilotic people are very, very integrated in their system. I think this is, like I said before, it's a model. And where this model collapsed is with the import of foreign agencies and with the coming of the Greeks at first, then the Romans, big culprits, and then, of course, the Arabs, the Islamic civilization. And we have a tremendous contrast now with what is Egypt today, as you can see it on television, in total chaos and confusion, whereas there you had a people living in a land that they were in total harmony with for thousands and thousands of years because they geared their social system to the land itself and the cycles of it. So this is what we have to learn from them. We've gone totally out of sync. We're heading towards disaster. And Robert Schock pointed out quite correctly, we're very short-term thinkers. Whereas, you know, we forget that this planet has been existing for 4.5 billion years. We're very, very early visitors here. And we need to reconnect with the rhythm of the planet. This is very much in my thinking these days. And in fact, my opening chapter of my book, Egypt Unveiled, deals specifically with that. So there you are. I really think that it is this disconnection with the natural rhythm of the planet that has sent us haywiring.
Is this not then a natural cycle in itself? I mean, even our disconnection, how the larger human civilization kind of wax and wanes, we've seen it in history, and maybe that is part of the cycle, Robert.
Yes, quite possibly. But there seems to have been a civilization, perhaps others, but again, I'm focusing on the Egyptian civilization, that seemed to have understood this and had a system, a social system and a religious system that was geared to this cyclical rhythm of the land. And the spiritual aspect of it, since others were talking about this, was that everything was sacred. the whole activity of nature was sacred. It's very visible when you study ancient Egypt. So this is something that needs to be regenerated in our social systems of today. You know, we're teaching kids all sorts of things, but we don't teach them about how to integrate themselves and fit themselves in a natural surrounding. So I'm, you know, in my old age of 60 plus, I'm very, very focused on this these days. I'm beginning to be more and more aware that this is the problem.
Laird, let me switch over to you. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Dogon. I mean, that's just such a fascinating example of a culture and a people that are still there today and have kept their tradition. They've conserved, if you will, their way of life. And I think that they've also kind of refused external influences. And do you think that that's what it would take, basically, to preserve something, just to have a very, very conserved society that does not, you know, go forward in any regard? And that's, you know, and there's a not a risk, perhaps, but there is a loss, if you will, that comes with that as well. How do you view that, Laird?
Well, my friend John Anthony West is a very vocal critic of the what he calls the religion of progress that has sprung up in modern society. And so, yes, our notions of what progress is need to change in order to bring us back into harmony with things. But a lot of the cultures that I study, the emphasis in their creation tradition is placed very largely on trying to point out to us what our real position in the larger scheme of creation is. Because as a society, especially in American society, we have come to see ourselves as the end product of creation. We're the top of the line, and this is as far as it goes, and everything in nature is here to serve us. In the Dogon mentality, and in the mentality of the other cultures I study who agree with the Dogon, we're not the top of the line. We're just another stage of creation, and there are other cycles that are larger than us. The macrocosmic cycle is an extension of the cycle that has produced what we see as the material world. And when you understand that we're not the top of the chain, then you take a different attitude about how you see your position and how you see your role.
Very good. John Ward, are you still there with us?
I'm still here, sir.
All right. I don't know if you've been listening or not. Do you have anything to add to this?
No, I've been listening attentively here. Two points. If I may start with Robert and the solar flare activity and so forth, as Scotty knows and some of our other dear friends know, I find that subject absolutely fascinating. I've actually incorporated some of the solar flare activity in Scotty and myself in our new book, The Exodus Reality, and that plays a major part in one of the apocalyptic events, and I won't give too much away in that. One thing I'd like to draw upon on the solar flare activity, which I don't hear that often, and Robert, you may have heard of this, of course, being much more of an expert on the subject than I, that is the Greek historian Herodotus wrote when he was in the company of the high priests of Memphis, I believe, and I'm not too sure if it was Memphis or not, I believe was Memphis, that he was recalled the story where the sun set where the sun rose and the sun rose where the sun set. And this would refer, of course, to a polar reversal. Now, the priests go on to say that this happened twice in the history of ancient Egypt. When Herodotus was there, which was around about 360 thereabouts BC. And he goes on to say that the neighbors suffered great famine and great plague while Egypt herself was unaffected, as if, as Robert Bavall says, that they lived in harmony, complete harmony with their surroundings, not just their landscape, but the River Nile, which is the life giving force for the ancient Egyptian civilization. Now, kind of coming away from that, as far as what Robert was saying, I kind of agree to a certain extent, but in another degree I don't. Also because I've lived amongst farming communities most of my life, and we are, I say we, I'm not a farmer, they are in harmony, I would say, with the landscape, the seasons and so forth. And even though our modern society has become completely detached from that harmony, so to speak, the farming and smaller communities, and as Robert quite rightly said, especially here in Egypt in the outskirts of the cities where I live, they are in total harmony still, especially with the Nile still, even though it's artificially risen each year by the opening of the Aswan Dam, they still perform rituals and festivals that hark back to the ancient Egyptians, where the Nile rises, and with its rising it brings fertility and so forth to the lands. And we have the Opet festival, which is now incorporated into the Islamic festival of Abu Hajjaj here in Luxor, where they carry the boat around the mosque, which is also within the temple of Luxor itself. Again, a harking back to the symbolic gesture of fertility of the land and so forth, and the harvest that will come. So I mean, it's fascinating. And you know, being here every day and immersed in this history as I am, I have this rather privileged, and it is privileged, and I give thanks every day for being here, a privileged insight into these wonderful ways in which these villagers still live their lives, and the history that surrounds them, way in which that is incorporated into their daily life. But that really does get me going. Yes, Lord.
I wanted to mention that there's a chapter in Emmanuel Velikovsky's book called his book Worlds in Collision, and the chapter is called East and West. And he enumerates similar evidence to what you just discussed about the reversals that happen from culture after culture, and discusses how some people try to interpret that statement as a statement of a change in the precessional cycle, or they interpret it in some other way. But when you compare the individual statements given from many different cultures, you realize that we almost have to be talking about a reversal of the poles of the earth.
Yeah.
Keep that thought as well, John, if you want to reply to that. I just wanted to give a few an opportunity to Marie to jump here. She needs to leave us in a few minutes here. But anything you want to add to this, Marie, as you've been hearing what the guy's talking about?
Oh, it's fascinating. You know, I think I love technology just like the next guy, but I really do think that our downfall could be not just our dependency on it, but our distraction. We're so distracted by technology that we have kind of forgot what's really important to us. I just want to mention something that my dad said to me. My dad was a geophysicist, Dr. John Savino. He died a couple of years ago. And we wrote a book together, which was so wonderful, called Supervolcano, the Catastrophic Event That Changed the Course of Human History. And we wrote about the Toba super eruption about 75,000 years ago in Sumatra and how it literally almost sent humanity into extinction. But one of the things my dad said to me, because we were talking about what if this happened today with Yellowstone or Long Valley Caldera or any other number of super volcanoes that might occur. I remember this, my dad said, it would be the most primitive people alive today, those little tribes tucked away in the Amazon, that would survive. And we, with our boastful technological progress and advancement, would be crippled. And I will never forget that. And I think it's true. But I have to say, I'm just as much a victim of it. I use technology all the time. I use it in my work. I communicate with my son, you know. But I do think that getting back to nature, I don't know if it's possible for all of us to really do that, but the people that are closest to the cycles of the earth, the people that can live off the land, the people that understand that connection, probably are at an advantage over those of us who can't live without our cell phones for an hour. So, you know, what irony, huh?
Well, indeed.
Care for this interview.
Well, I think we should use it when it's there and when we have the capacity.
Absolutely. But oh, and there's so many benefits to technology. But I think, you know, dependency and distraction, those are two things that I think as a collective we really need to be aware of.
Indeed, very good.
I've got to jump in here because I'll be leaving you soon as well. Can I jump in and comment
go
on
ahead.
What Marie
Definitely.
Said?
Go ahead, Robert Bevall.
First of all, well done, Marie. I just love the way you put it. It's precisely my way of looking at things these days. Laird mentioned East and West. I happen to be a sort of living East and West. I've revealed my age a minute ago. I'm 65 years old. I've spent 30 years in the East and the rest of the time in the West, in Western Europe. So I've had literally my feet in both sides of the coin, if that's the right expression. And I've been living in places where there was a very close integration to nature. I've lived in parts of West Africa and worked there. I've been very lucky to spend 5 years in the early 70s in the Sultanate of Oman, where it was emerging from a virtually middle-aged society. And it was very interesting to see how modern society, our Western society, came in and butted against this and corrupted quite a lot of the natural ways of these people. So I think it's not going to be possible to return to nature. It's definitely not feasible. But we need to do something, and Laird mentioned something here. It's this church of progress. We need to consider what human progress is, rather than see it as purely a technological and scientific progress. So that's my two cents in this argument before I leave you. We need to redress our sense of priority and progress. I think that's the key here. It's not going to be easy because, of course, we're very dependent on technology. I agree with Marie. I, of course, am using technology every day with my computers and phones and so forth. But we need to get priorities redressed again. And this has to go through the education process. So there you are. I'll have to leave you because my wife is flying a flag and we've got our meal burning.
So. All right.
It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure being with all of you, and enjoy the rest of the year. And see you all. See you all very soon in October.
Great hearing you, Robert. See you in October.
Very good. Thank you, Robert, and thank you, Marie, as well. I think Marie dropped off. You're still there? Yeah, I think she left us as well. Well, thank you, Robert Bevall, Marie D. Jones, and we'll continue with the rest of the guys that we have with us here. And I wanted to switch over to you a little bit, Micah, because you know you have some interesting ideas as well on the future, and I think. Don't know if you would agree with me in this, but it seems to me as well that we've kind of been in a gap right now between attaining a certain level of technology, perhaps, where we actually can have, where we maybe not are so dependent on it anymore, but it's a new version, if you will, or a more, how should we put it, not so fragile in a sense. I mean, if we look forward into like the, you know, the UFO phenomena, for example, and we talk about new propulsion systems, maybe zero point energy, etc., there are things I think potentially down the horizon, down the line, that actually could lead to a more liberated humanity, perhaps. Perhaps. What's your thoughts on this, Micah?
I certainly agree with you on that, Henrik. But you know, I think that there's this interesting dichotomy that emerges because what we're confronted with is that we know that humans, and I do feel this, especially from speaking with my friends, you know, who have more. Who have background with indigenous cultures and who are, you know, actually descendants of Native American cultures and things like that. I do think that we have, as humans, evolved to be the humans that we are today, and that primarily this came from thousands and thousands of years of living. I think in simpler, there are obvious instances where there have been very complex and specialized technologies utilized by ancient peoples, but I think that nonetheless we've utilized more simple values. The kind of technologies implemented have not strayed so far away from the spiritual and from the earth, literally. One colleague of mine and I, catching up and speaking, and of course you know how this is, most of us, you know, we're displaced all around the world as we are just in this conversation here. This gentleman is overseas, and he and I had an opportunity, a rare opportunity, to catch up the other night. And he had told me that he feels that in the event of some oncoming catastrophe in our imminent future, that perhaps the only way that humankind can continue would be to revert back to something akin to the hunter-gatherer societies and the more tribalistic kind of mode of living that we, of course, sustained for thousands of years prior to the relatively short period of growth that we've seen since the last two industrial revolutions that have led to the technological society that we are today. Now, for me, I find myself most comfortable and happiest, you know, when I'm, you know, out in nature, when I'm meditating, when I'm one with the earth, so to speak. I love to get out and jog in the mornings, and I live in the mountains of Western North Carolina, so that's very much a part of me, and I feel more in tune with the world and with reality and with myself when I'm in nature. And nonetheless, the dichotomy that I mentioned earlier kind of emerges from my focus on, in the last couple of years, science of the future. My last New Page Books release was a book called The UFO Singularity that, again, has baffled many of my fellow skeptics because they feel that I've employed singularity inappropriately. It can mean many things, and typically singularity means one of two things, and as Red Ice listeners would probably know it. Singularity can mean, of course, the kind of metaphysical concept of spiritual singularity, oneness with oneself. In more popular usage today, we refer to technological singularity, which is the literal creation of artificial intelligence. Yep. Some have termed it as the merging of man with machine. In the UFO singularity, I look at the latter of those two, just to be clear, because again, I had one popular skeptical writer say recently that Hanks appears to mean something different from any other common usage of singularity when he talks about this. That's not the case. Huh. I merely look at technological singularity and the creation of advanced, perhaps artificial intelligences on down the road in juxtaposition along with what we already perceive as being a highly advanced technology as represented by UFOs. I do not assert that technological understanding of UFO phenomenon today necessarily proves that we're dealing with extraterrestrial intelligence, but I certainly think that there is something to the UFO phenomenon and that it presents in our immediate, you know, reality, our consensus reality, I think in the best instances, good physical evidence of something. Some have argued that there's good physical evidence, but even the Condon Committee, which was one of the more skeptical and scientific studies of UFOs in the last 50 years or so, even they concluded that there were some UFO cases that existed in the Blue Book files of the 1950s and 60s that were representative of a phenomenon of some sort. Again, we don't know what that is, but there's something going on. I don't think that can be denied. And so I sought to try and look at UFO phenomenon within the context of projections of future science. Now, what's interesting about this is that, and coming back around to what you'd said, why I agree with you is because I do think that we are headed toward a future where certain technologies will perhaps make life and certain existential and even ecological and economic issues that we are faced with here on Earth today, scarcity, food supply, diminishing amounts of crops and things like this, especially in the face of population growth. I think that a lot of these things may be circumvented and even corrected or fixed or warded off with effective implementation of technology. But with the good, there also comes bad. As some of our other panelists here have discussed, there is also that imminent potential that as humans become more reliant on technology, that we literally set ourselves up for potential hardships and dangers. Yeah. So I think that there are both. And I think that Robert Schock, you know, he and I having spoken about this a good bit, we have to look at the potential, for instance, mass coronal ejections and things like that. Will our technology reach this singular point that the futurists of today, and that I've written about fairly extensively as well, will we reach that point? Will we be able to literally take human evolution into our own hands and direct where we go from here, utilizing technology before nature circumvents that, as maybe some evidence already shows has taken place in the past. So there is a bit of a dichotomy. And certainly I think that there is a potential for goodness and for growth with technology, but I wonder sometimes if nature, in the proverbial sense, will even allow for that to take place.
Well, it's an interesting point, and obviously there have been some major warnings about this line of progression as well as we enter into a past that basically we cannot revert back from. And even, you know, obviously as all the sci-fi, we were talking about mythology earlier, but I mean, the majority of our sci-fi that we have today that we get through us, kind of carries this warning, I guess, of when a machine intelligence becomes alive and becomes our worst enemy in a way. And of course, that might be, you know, some people say it's just scaremongering and et cetera. But all of these aspects are variables within any system that we create, Mike. And therefore, I mean, if we enter into that path, do you think that there is a way to ever reverse back out of it and exit out of that choice, if you will?
That's a good question, too, because I think a lot of theorists, and we have to point out, again, I try to be you know, conservative in my presentation about these things, only because I think that we have to take baby steps. And if we really want to think boldly, I'll do so, but I'll state that I'm speculating in doing so. I'm speculating here because, again, we have nothing to compare to when we think about artificial intelligence. All we have is what we see, as you've pointed out correctly, in films. And then, of course, what we have also is, you know, known advanced intelligence, which is ourselves, humans. I do think, however, though, that when we project concerns about the fears of the future and also how we may be able to come back from that if we get to a point where we're, you know, for instance, our technology gets out of hand and we have something like the Terminator films, I think that we often look at those potentials from a woefully anthropomorphic kind of viewpoint. When we go looking for aliens, for instance, I feel that we're not looking for aliens, we're looking for humans, because we anthropomorphize human ideals and values onto what we presume would be an advanced exotic intelligence. We do the same thing with artificial intelligence just as well, and I think that there are two things that need to be taken into consideration in that discussion, and they are, one, the philosophical concept of embodied cognition, in which we have to question whether the mode of intelligence and the actions that an intelligent sentient being will take are also due to, for instance, with humans, we see it takes place both in conjunction with our ability to think and to be able to imply logic and apply it to you know, what we do and how we act. But then there's also the chemical and the metabolic factor just as well. You know, we have a sex drive and we have a need to procreate, and therefore we have a need to compete. We have to feed ourselves. And so all of these physiological factors do very, very much so influence our ability and even at times perhaps override logic. A computer intelligence may not be so susceptible to those kinds of things. Then I also think that we have to take into consideration, in addition to all that, that it may not be that we will be able to so simply create intelligence utilizing artificial intelligence. I think that we may find, as we get closer to the advent of synthetic intelligences, that rather than creating a computer that thinks like a human, we create essentially a structure that allows for the entry of consciousness. And then we'll begin to find out that, much as Carl Jung and others have supposed, this notion of a collective consciousness may come more into play with this. And singularity, to me, may have less to do with creating intelligent machines and creating technologies that allow the, or that are, maybe we might even say, conductors of consciousness as we are as physical beings. And that may be more along the lines of there being a merging between man and machine. But again, the question at the end of the day to me is, will that be a good thing? And I think we're too far out to be able to really suppose the ins and outs of that argument without having been there. So we'll have to kind of wait and see and proceed with caution.
If I could jump in here really quickly, just because I'm a geologist, well, not because I'm a geologist, but I have a geological perspective,
yep.
I want to point out that 99.9, people argue about how many nines go after that, but, well, the vast majority, let's just put it that way, of species that have ever lived on Earth are extinct, and many of them reached heights of, you know, peaks of abundance, that type of thing, just before they went extinct. Many of them specialized, became very vulnerable, then went extinct. And again, you know, one can argue that maybe humans are somehow not part of nature, but I think that's a mistake. And I think we it's hard to predict the future, but we could become very vulnerable, and I worry about this, very vulnerable, and reach a real peak. And everything looks wonderful one day, and, you know, there's devastation the next day because of something totally out of our control, maybe even something totally unpredictable.
Yeah.
And, you know, Robert, I was going to mention, and you, Micah, which you just vaguely hit on there in a sideways sort of way, is that whole philosophical argument that comes into this whole transhuman or artificial intelligence. Say you could take a human brain and implant it into machinery later on. What will you have as a result? Theoretically, you could say, I have, chemically speaking, I have the essence of this person here, embodied in this transhuman piece of robotry, to use an archaic term for it, or in artificial intelligence. And yet the big question has to be asked is would that capture then truly the essence of that person, or would it capture the biology of that person? And that's where you start to get into with all of this. It opens up, even though it's not meant to be part of the initial argument, it has to open up that argument of philosophy, of of spirituality, if you will. What is it that creates? And Robert, you had just said that, you know, unless, in so many words, you said, unless we are something different than the rest of the types of animals and existence on this planet that have passed out of existence, unless we are unique, we could be very susceptible to that ourselves.
And not just animals. I want to add, not just animals. If you look at anthropology and physical anthropology and the history of our, not species, I'll use the technical term here, but hominids and human-related species, the vast majority of human species have gone extinct.
Yeah.
And then the big question is there an extinction that is an extinction of a facet of human society? Let's say, for instance, could you say we are maybe on the cusp of this right now, but one of the frustrations, one of the major frustrations of technology for me might seem a small thing for somebody else, but when I'm texting somebody on my phone and my phone wants to change the spelling of the word for me, and I have to type that word 5 or 6 different times, then enter it into the lexicon on the phone, make it a part of the dictionary so I can actually misspell my own word. If I am, say, in humor making up a word, I can't do that. And it's frustrating to me that we have such a dumbed down society that we have cell phones with built-in word spelling so you can't misspell your words, because 99.999999% of the people out there don't know how to spell words. And so is this indicative of a certain type of extinction of a mode of humanity or a facet of humanity? We are moving into something else.
Well, it seems, you know, on picking up on your point there as well, Robert Schock, it seems that what happened in the past with previous, you know, if you can call it that, then versions of you know, mankind and hominids and everything else, that there was an update, if you will, that occurred at some point along the line. And at certain times, of course, there's been 2 or maybe even 3 of these versions, you know, around at the same time. But just as that struggle that, you know, we allegedly had with the Neanderthals, there was something new that came into the picture and the old kind of fell off, if you will. And of course, that's a very dramatic scenario, but maybe we're talking about something similar here, that we're at the cusp of a new human, if you will, to a certain extent. It might not be biological differences, but actually, I guess, more related to consciousness, etc. And that's what we're kind of faced with right now.
Right. I was going to say, I was about to mention Neanderthals, and you just did, because Neanderthals were incredibly successful species of humans. They survived over 100,000 years. That's, you know, our species, Homo sapiens sapiens, is about 30, 40,000 years, depending on who you talk to or where you count the first specimens. So, and to bring up the point you just brought up too, depending on how, and I'm trained in part as a paleontologist systematist, but at certain points in time, there's good documentation that there were 4, 5, 6 different human species alive on the planet somewhere simultaneously.
Wow. That's amazing. And so what would that mean? And this can, anyone can pick up on this. If we're at that cusp right now, what would the next change be? If it's true that, you know, as you said, Scotty, that we're kind of in this idiocracy scenario right now, where a majority of people are kind of just driven, if you will, by the parameters that the society has provided for them. But it's only maybe those individuals who are trying to achieve something outside of that box that actually are ready to, you know, to continue. I know that sounds harsh, but any thoughts on that, Scotty, or anyone else?
Well, I actually want to defer this over to Micah, because I know Micah is the futurist in the group here, and he is somebody that I see has a good handle on all the philosophy behind this. So all that to say, I'm bailing on that particular answer because I don't know enough about it. I get a little more stuck in history and stuck in the past than I do thinking about where we're going from here. So, Micah, why don't you pick that one up?
Well, I mean, yeah, I'll be glad to, Scotty. You know, and something I have to point out too is that I think you can be a person who studies a particular philosophy, avenue of thought, you know, particular field of interest, and you don't necessarily have to become a cheerleader or an advocate for that. And so, this is again something that I often point out. I see Michio Kaku is often criticized for talking about warp drives and things like this, because this is not science that exists yet, and many maintain that this science will never exist. We will never be like what we see on Star Trek. Now, that may or may not be the case. We don't know. But I think that you shouldn't necessarily criticize someone merely for engaging in brainstorming and speculation, especially if it's reasoned. And I think that the difference between reasoned speculation and then unwieldy speculation is somebody can say, well, what if there were pink dinosaurs that came down and started, you know, colonizing planet Earth? I mean, would that be the end of the human race? What if they wanted to eat us? There doesn't seem to be any kind of reason to suppose that that's necessarily going to happen. Whereas when we look at the idea of something like, for instance, Sasquatch or Bigfoot, it's very difficult for people in modern academia to accept the notion that there is something so man-like that could still exist on remote portions of the planet Earth, despite the fact that there, I think, is a very reasonable survey that was written by the zoologist Ivan Sanderson in the 1950s called Abominable Snowman Legend Come to Life, that looks at the potentials of there being, you know, reports of such creatures all around the Earth. And of course, as Dr. Schock has pointed out, this is not just the reports of large hominid types that we would presume to be a Sasquatch. This also has to do with small hominid types, beings that are perhaps both less advanced than humans, but also physically smaller than humans just as well. Now, I think that when we look at the fossil record, we know that, as Dr. Schock also just pointed out, there have been periods throughout history where many different varieties of humans, or at very least we would say hominids, have existed on planet Earth at one time. And again, I'm not necessarily trying to make a case for there being a Sasquatch, but engaging in what I would call reasonable speculation here. Why would this particular era in the history of planet Earth be particularly different from a previous period when there were as many as five different varieties of hominids perhaps existing alongside one another? Engaging in that line of thought, we might be able to say that at very least, physically, there's not much that would prevent the existence of a creature like a Bigfoot on planet Earth in conjunction with modern Homo sapiens. Now, that also, that's looking backwards, I think, but looking ahead, I think that when it comes to where we will go and where humans are destined to go, one of the general concepts that is espoused by the singularitarians, so this is, you know, a term that was coined by Ray Kurzweil, who's probably the most the figurehead, if you will, of the singularity philosophy. And really, I truly think it's becoming a movement just as well. And that's another reason why I say I'll talk about it. I've studied it intensely. I'm not an advocate of it per se, and I'm not someone who's here to endorse it. But I'm merely a researcher who is very interested in this, and I think that it has implications that we will have to face and have to adhere to on down the road. Ray Kurzweil and others have said that this may very likely be the end of humanity as we know it. And whether we look at it as being technology will eventually take us to a point where humans may no longer even be what we know as humans today, or if we look backwards or recursively and say perhaps that we may be dealing with a future where at some point nature will intervene and take us back to a more primitive state from where we were, whether that be intellectually for some strange reason. Maybe humans will be wiped out or something similar to humans will come along again. That certainly happened in the past. It could happen again, I think. Again, I think that what we are looking at in the future is the potential, not necessarily the guarantee, but the potential for big change. And again, the best we can do as researchers is speculate about that. We can look to the ancient past, and as we begin to unravel mysteries, we can come 99.999%, as it's been said during this conversation a few times, 99.999 with a line over it percent certain as to what may have taken place in ancient times. We may not know fully because we can't travel through time and go back and experience that, at least yet. With the future, we can look to the future. We can't go to the future yet. We cannot see. We can only predict what we think is going to happen. And I've tried to do that as well as other futurists, if you will, or as they sometimes call themselves, futurologists. And yes, Dr. Ward, I do believe that some of them employ that as an actual word. Then again, acknowledging that language is arbitrary and that people, if they need to, as Scotty Roberts has said, can create words if that best fits the circumstances. The futurologists will often look to the future and they will say that, maybe we are going to literally take evolution into our own hands, but we don't know, and we can only speculate based on the technological trends of today as to where we're going to go. Again, for me, that's a big question and a big problem because I don't know if we're going to be going off in a direction where we'll have jetpacks and we'll be colonizing the moon and we'll be merging with machines, or if we may revert back to the way that humans were before the advent of totalitarian agriculture, in which, we begin to take control of human evolution through the utilization of you know, the control and the supply of food? You know, will we revert back to simpler things as a result of the way that nature inevitably has shown in the past to intervene? It's an incredible question, and I think we have to look at both possibilities in terms of where humans will eventually end up on the map.
Indeed, very good. Now, what about intervention of some kind, the possibility of outside assistance? I mean, many of the, you know, myths discuss this in some cases in some detail of you know, where they came from in some instances. If something else indeed has kind of started off the progression that we are on now, and this could be various possibilities. It could be just simply the concepts of what we know as civilization. It could be, go much deeper than that, even into, you know, the speculation of genetic manipulation and everything else. But maybe we're in a situation where we're not really good at handling of where it's going, because we weren't, I guess, responsible of starting off the path that we're on right now anyway. Any thoughts on this?
Well, I would say right away that I think that there is a lot of thought, notion. You almost don't want to put it into the category of theory yet, because theory requires a lot more than just ideas. There's a lot of notion out there, and perhaps some theorizing that there was paleo contact with ancient humans. I know Laird can speak to this with his work on the Dogon. Dr. Schock, I'm not sure what all you have covered on this particular topic itself, but it seems to me that with all the talk you get out there, and it seems a little wacky to me at times, this talk of ancient civilization could not have had the ingenuity or the genius or the ability to create the monolithic structures they created and things like that, that they needed outside help. I don't think that. John Ward can attest to this. When we were sitting inside the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid and seeing many of these other things just this last January and February, I looked at John at one point and I said, it's very obvious to me that this place was built by a bunch of guys. And there were guys who knew what they were doing. Somebody understood the math and somebody understood how to make this thing work. Now, of course, the notion or the theory is that there was help in understanding how to make those structures work. And it seems to be, it's like in all of these theoretical, let's just use theory, otherwise I'm going to keep jumping back and forth between the words. There's all this theoretical information out there that says there are all these evidences that say, that seem to say it was aliens, it was extraterrestrial involvement, there was some other involvement. You can, but frankly, if you even go into spirituality, you go into religion, you are going to find that, yes, there was outside help. It says even God helped Adam and Eve figure out how to make clothes out of animal skins, if you go into the book of Genesis. So you've got just about everything out there in our ancient past. Some help came from somewhere. It came from the gods. It came from people that we maybe called gods. Everything that we labeled as gods, devils, angels, demons, and everything in between was ancient man's interpretation of what they encountered. Or perhaps it was just as archaeology or anthropology might tell us, and that is man just simply evolved, and there was this equality of evolution in several cultures where they all came up with the same kinds of stories, mythologies, without ever having encountered each other in ancient times. So my thinking is, and people have tried to put me on the spot on this. It was a good, for instance, when I wrote the book on the reptilians and the mythology of it all, somebody says, so, Scotty, tell us, where do you believe? Do you believe the reptilians are here? And I said, you know, when you put me on the spot like that, I have to say it's an intriguing theory, but I don't know. And as Dr. John Ward has said to me many times, he'll say to me, Scotty, we weren't there, and we don't know.
Yeah,
and so all we can do is look at what's there and try to decipher it from that.
Yeah, try to piece it all together.
Right.
Well, if there's anything that we could learn from the past, and I would use this as a point to begin to round things up on then for this time, if there's anything from the past that we could learn from, or, you know, as a property, if you will, to be able to make it into the unknown future on the path that we're on right now, what that would be from the different, you know, studies that you've all have made. Robert Schock, if we begin with you, any suggestions, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think I've tried to say this already in the past couple of hours. I think we really need to learn from the ancients that we need to pay attention to cycles, and particularly long-term cycles. And I am absolutely convinced that things are not always smooth and easy sailing when it comes to nature, should we say. That yes, and again, coming from a geological point of view, yes, asteroids hit sometimes, and there's very good evidence that one hit and killed all the dinosaurs and a lot of other fauna and flora 65 million years ago, so that's maybe an extreme example, but there are these cycles. There was a major event, I believe, at the end of the last ice age. Things could happen like that again. You have the many different cultures talking about a cyclical change on long-term basis. For instance, the Yuga cycle, which we didn't talk about, but maybe I can talk about that at the conference. The precessional cycle that I mentioned before, the concept of the golden age, silver age, etc. And when you look at the ancient mythologies, and I take mythology very seriously, these cycles are not just gradual transitions from one to the other. They generally, one cycle ends in catastrophe, major sudden changes, and then something new is born from that. And I think that ties in with maybe the peak that we're reaching at this moment as we become more and more technologically advanced. I don't want to be a doomsayer. I don't want to be a scaremonger, but I am concerned that we are going above and beyond what we know what we're dealing with and making ourselves very vulnerable. And this may have happened in the past. There have been rises of civilization. There have been dark ages more than once.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of is a revamp of the Atlantis myth in a way, where the fall from the top of the peak of the mountain, if you will, as we think that we've reached the pinnacle of everything, and then we're like, you know, ready to just, you know, or something is going to come around, a variable, as you mentioned before, Robert, that we haven't thought about or at all, you know, considered. And this is what basically knocks us off our place. But again, this might be a natural cycle in itself. This might be how we are part of it, you know?
Yeah, it may be a natural cycle unto itself, but if it is, at least I think we would do well, it would behoove us to understand those natural cycles. And the Atlantis myth is, everyone's heard of it, the Atlantis myth, I hope. And it does talk about this. And part of the Atlantis myth is that it did not happen just once with Atlantis, but in fact, this was part of a larger cycle.
Indeed. Laird, how about you? And again, in your work, I mean, there are talks, of course, of outsiders, if you will, that gives knowledge when it comes to the Dogon and many other tribes as well. But is there anything that we can learn and keep, I guess, from that, from those stories to be able to make it, if you will?
Well, sure. And addressing some of the things we've just been talking about, in Egypt, there's a tradition of the first time. In Buddhism, they talk about the first time that information was transmitted to humanity. In the Dogon culture, there's a memory of a time when humanity was restored to culture, which implies that it wasn't the first time. So in all of these traditions, there's the idea that we have had help and that we may have had help more than once. I think that the bottom line for me is that once humanity recognizes their true place in the scheme of nature, that we're going to have more respect for nature in general. And that really is the message that's being communicated here, is that we're getting multiple chances here to honor our place in nature. And until we do that, we may be subject to these reversals.
Indeed. John Ward, if we shift over to you, any suggestions and points on some of these thoughts?
Well, again, I've listened to everybody else here, and they're all experts in their field, and I feel a little bit out of my water, really. From my point of view, I suppose, for me, being immersed in all of this history is a reminder, and I totally agree with what Robert was saying about the cycles and so forth, and that is that it doesn't matter what part of our history we're looking at. Anthropologically speaking, mankind, or the concept of mankind, let's put it that way, the development over the millions of years has continued and will, I hope, continue, regardless of any cataclysmic event and so forth. And when I look at the Egyptians, I look at what they built and, you know, their temples, the shrines, the monuments here in Thebes. I mean, the name, the actual name, when you translate them from the hieroglyphic, is houses of millions of years. They were built to last millions of years because they believed that their spirit could return daily and feast and drink with the living occupants of that place. And so for me to take away from this is basically that we are part and parcel of a continuation, a cycle in itself, regardless of intervention, whether we are ourselves the intervention. We are continually evolving. And I just look around me here, and I'm here now, as I say, in the quarries of Gebel El Sassila. And I've spent the last 5 days now looking at various different techniques, extraction techniques, how they moved 2-ton blocks of stone just by their hands, using handmade rope, rollers, and so forth, and how they moved them down the side of the mountain to the riverbank and put them onto the barges, and then sailed the barges up to the temple places, and then put them in place, and the masons dressed them, and so forth. So for me, it's a continuation. That's what it comes to, a continuation, and we will continue to evolve. I hope
so too. Yeah, Micah, any last thoughts?
Well, absolutely, and I should also make the observation. I think it becomes a bit difficult to have this sort of a discussion outside the frame of what becomes somewhat eschatological, you know. And yeah, there is both with the discussion of our origins, you know, there's the inevitable discussion of you know, where it's all going to resolve. And again, I don't think that any of us wish to look at this as being you know, a situation where there is an inevitable end of humanity, and therefore, you know, scare tactics have to come into a question. I know Dr. Schock very eloquently points out that, you know, he doesn't want to be sensationalist about it, but, you know, we also have to look at history and take into considerations the messages that we get from the study of history. It's been said more than once that we study history so that we don't make the same mistakes that were made in the past. And whether you want to consider it, you know, human errors or just merely the non-adherence to cyclical factors with nature, if we do study history and we do study our origins, we may be more formidable and better set for progressing and meeting the challenges that the future will inevitably hold. And if there's one thing for certain that we do know about the study of history, is that at any point, at any time, at every turn, humans throughout the past and throughout the last several centuries, the last thousands of years, and of course since time immemorial, we have encountered change and we have encountered hardships. Those are not beyond us and behind us entirely. We will encounter more. But again, by studying the ancient past, we are perhaps better equipped to meet those new challenges in the future.
Very good. And then finally, let's hand this over to Scott as well, so if you have any closing thoughts on this. And then also want to make sure that we give out the symposium website again and let our listeners know where they can go to pick up tickets and everything else.
Certainly. I would have to think right away to the Hindu philosophy, their whole philosophy of the universe, the multiverse, if you will. It was always in flux. It was always moving. It was always changing. And there's all kinds of stories from the Hindu Puranas that talk about this perpetual creation and destruction of the universe. And that we're supposedly even now in one of the final cycles of that before it recycles over again. And that there's this new earth and this new universe that constantly keep remaking themselves. To say that that is the absolute truth, of course, I would have to be Hindu, which I am not. So I don't know if that is the absolute truth of it. But all of these things that we talk about with all of these people you've had on this show today, this shows all kinds of philosophy that is brought to the table, all kinds of ists, all kinds of isms, all kinds of things that we think about. And that is the beauty of all of these people being together at this one time, is being able to talk over the table in a kind of this round table discussion about these things. And I like the reason I brought up the ists and the isms is it reminds me of something that Neil deGrasse Tyson had said. He said, other than being a scientist, he says, I'm not any other kind of ist. He says, these ists and these isms are all philosophies. They're philosophies, they're philosophical portfolios, if you will, that people attach themselves to. And then the philosophy does the thinking for you if you're not careful. And so the key is to, instead of having your philosophy do the thinking for you, is you do the thinking yourself. And that is what I have to say, and segue right into the Paradigm Symposium. That is what we're all about at the Paradigm Symposium. It's thinking yourself through all these different questions of where we came from and ultimately where are we going. The subtitle for this year's Paradigm Symposium is Revisioning Our Place in History. And history is a thing that's ongoing constantly. It's perpetual. It's always changing. It's not just a study of the past. It's a study of where we're going. And so for your listeners of this program, I'm going to state it again, they can go to paradigmsymposium.com, then add a /redice. And this is your own private page over there for Red Ice. Paradigmsymposium.com/redice. And you'll see all about the symposium, and there will be special ticket prices for you as you scroll to the bottom of the page, 20% and 30% off. You'll see the details there. We'd love to see you here. It's October 17th through the 20th. We have everybody who's been on this panel today on this show will be there, plus several others. Go take a look at the site and avail yourself of that information and get your tickets.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that, Scotty. Much appreciated. We're going to have that linked up as well, of course. And I want to thank everyone for your time today, of course, for joining us for this roundtable here. We've been talking with Robert Schock, Laird Scranton, Micah Hanks, John Ward joined in as well. Also, Scotty Roberts, and my thanks to Marie D. Jones and Robert Beauval for joining us earlier. And as I said, links are going to be up on redicecreations.com. So check right there in case you want to find out more about this work and the symposium, of course. I also want to squeeze in a big thanks to our friend Gary Evans there. We're from Infinite Connections for helping us to pull this program together. But in conclusion, great talking with you all. Please keep up the good work. You all have so much to add to the puzzle that we are trying to piece together. So keep at it, and I hope we all have a great time at the symposium. Thank you, gentlemen. And there you go. That's our program for this time. Some of our upcoming guests include the second half with William Engdahl, then Charles Eisenstein, David Livingstone, Neil Sanders, Anthony Peake, and Neil Kramer, to name a few. We're also working on some new exciting material right now as well, so keep your eye on the websites for all the latest. For now, we say thank you for listening and for your support as a member. My thanks to everyone at Red Ice. We'll speak to you in just a few days again, and please take care and proceed with caution, focus, and determination.